I kind of worked harder and I worked harder, and I always just assumed that I would succeed. And I don't really know where that comes from, but self-belief is incredibly important to success.
Welcome to the 39ers podcast, a podcast by Business SA. This podcast will dive deep into the people and businesses that drive the change in South Australia. The 39ers are a community of forward-thinking, high-achieving business leaders aged 40 and under, creating a think tank of ideas, inspiration and opportunity that will shape the future of South Australia and beyond. This show is a gateway to the captivating stories, the inspiring journeys and the insightful conversations with some of South Australia's best and brightest minds in business who are shaping our state. I'm Tim Leavis and I'm from Business SA. Today we will be speaking with Jess McDonald. Jess is the Executive Director of Yanam Project Services and is a founding member of the 39ers. Known for her strong leadership and decisive nature, Jess is a highly motivated individual who excels at driving project and practice direction. Jess's ability to think outside the box and harness her creativity has enabled her to overcome challenges and achieve success in the construction world. Today, we delve into her experiences and leadership insights in this engaging conversation. Welcome, co-founder of Yanam Projects, Jess McDonald. Welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for coming on the show, and it's great to have you here. First of all, I just want to know, what's keeping you busy at the moment?
A few years ago, my husband and I co-founded Yanam Project Services, as you've just said. He took carriage of that in the first instance while I was still employed at Oricon as in a client strategy role. I've recently resigned in the last few months and I am now fully Yananized.
Great.
So he and I are leading that business together, where we've got a team of 14, including he and I, which is great. And that has grown from 1 to 14 in just under 2 years. So it's pretty rapid growth, actually.
Yeah, some big growth there.
Yeah, it's exciting.
That's great. So tell us about Yanam Project Services. How did it all start?
So I met my husband in a nightclub when I was 19 and he was 21, a nightclub in King's Cross, actually. So where all best romances begin, I imagine. And I was studying architecture at the time. He was in the military. He was actually a clearance diver in the Navy. And then over the next few years, I finished my architecture degree. He moved across into the Army in a counterterrorism team group. And spent some time in Iraq. As he was doing that, I was working in architecture, building up my career portfolio. And over the last sort of 10 years, he got out of the military, wasn't really sure what to go into after that. He was offered some training or a budget for training by the military, about 10 grand or something like that. He spent some of it on a boating license or something, and he had a bucket of money left. My dad, who was also in the construction industry, my whole family is, he said to Dave, why don't you go and do a Primavera P6 course? It's an expensive course and companies don't like to pay for it. And so Dave went and did this course. He had a bit of trouble in the course because he actually didn't have any construction experience, but he did it and then started trying to get a job in the construction industry. He had a bit of trouble at first because there were organisations like DIT and others who said, we're really interested in you, we'd love to hire you, but you don't actually have any experience. And so Dave said to them, Dave has a lot of resilience and grit and he has built that out over his whole life, I imagine. And he said to them, you tell me what I need to do. What do I need to do to get a job in this industry? And they said, go and get a graduate certificate of project management. So he walked down to the uni and he signed up. He pitched to them how he could actually get into a master's degree when he didn't have a bachelor's, and they took him in. He did the graduate certificate. He then tried to get a job. He called John Holland, who had a grad program, training program going at the time. And he applied for the graduate position. And they said, we'd really love to hire you, but you're a little bit too old for the graduate position. I see on your certificate, I see on your resume that you've done a Primavera P6 course. And he said, yes, I have. And they said, are you interested in joining the planning team? And he said, yes, I definitely am. And they organised an interview and he got off the phone and he called me and he said, what's planning? And I said, I think it's that course you did. That's scheduling. That's what, you know, that's one of the things that Dad does, give him a call. So we did. Anyway, he went for the interview. He went for the job and in 18 months he was the lead planner on an $800 million project.
Wow.
Which goes to show, and I talk to a lot of our staff and my children about this, is that sometimes in life doors open for you, but it is actually you that needs to walk through it and make the most of that. And so from then, Dave became a planner, a scheduler. He became a really, really good scheduler. He got some experience in the mining industry and then in defence project management. And I, at that time, had been state manager of a project and cost management company, Aquenta. Aquenta was then sold to Jacobs, and at which time I chose to join Oricon, who are also engineers, big global engineering company, in the client strategy role. And there was starting to be what Dave and I could feel as a kind of social awakening, a reckoning around First Nations kind of encouragement. It started with the Indigenous procurement policies that started coming from government and now has ramped up over the last few years in terms of organisations, initially big organisations, writing RAP plans and the like. And so on the back of that, Dave and I decided that we both had, by coincidence or design, skills in the same industry, which is pretty unusual for husband and wife. Yep. And we had not the same skills, we had complementary skills. And that's pretty special as well. I had sort of business management and he has very technical skills. So together we are a really great team. So we thought we'd roll the dice. I was earning good money, so we thought it was very sensible for Dave to start what was in the early days and still is an Indigenous project management business because my husband is Aboriginal. And that is where Yunnan began.
Wow. What a story. What a story indeed. And so then in regards to your background specifically, you know, you spoke heavily of Dave there, which is fantastic. And as you said to me earlier, that you could speak all day about him.
Yeah.
This is not about Dave.
Dave is pretty amazing and I actually could talk about him all day. I think he's incredible.
And part of this is really getting to understand you, Jess. So you've got an architecture background, construction. You've just said then as well, the family in construction as well.
Yeah.
So how do you go from architecture into where you are now?
It's a relatively simple transition. There are many architects who become project managers. But I guess what got me into architecture was, as you say, family business. My parents have an engineering company which was very small growing up. My dad used to work on initially when I before I was born very big pieces of infrastructure, dams, roads, those sorts of things. And my mum became very unhappy living in the city, so she said to him, well, you're traveling anyway, you could do this from anywhere. So we went and moved to the country. So I grew up in the country, regional New South Wales, in what was then a very small town. And my dad set up a one-man band initially, and then that grew a little bit bigger and it grew a little bit bigger, and now he has offices in still in regional New South Wales but also in Sydney and Newcastle and Manchester in the UK, and they work on all the big things like the South Thames Crossing and the Harbour Bridge tunnel duplication, WestConnex, any big sort of pieces of infrastructure they do a lot of the cost estimating of. So growing up in a family business means that dining table conversations are about business constantly. So you absorb this stuff by osmosis. So interestingly, I was having a conversation last night actually with a new 39er, which is really exciting that we have new members coming in. And she said, wow, 14 people over 18 months, that's pretty great growth. How are you coping with that? And I think I was actually a little bit surprised by that question because it has coping is it sounds negative, and actually all Dave and I are seeing at the moment is the opportunity of that growth. And I think part of that is because from the get-go, we've been putting systems and processes and things in place for a big business. And we fit a small business within that big business kind of profile. And so the growth is exciting because we are actually just meeting the opportunity of that profile, I think.
It's great. It's absolutely great. So let's take us back to that roundtable discussion with the family. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that really stands out with you in that discussion where you take that away and you bring it to either work every day or your business every day, or a mantra that you've picked up from that table?
Oh, that is interesting. I think while my parents were had very good business acumen, and Dad had a lot of technical skills, the thing that stands out for me about them is how they treated their staff. They really treated them like family. They employed a lot of local youth, I guess, who may have started going wayward, but instead they brought them into the business and trained them to be cost estimators. Because cost estimating and scheduling, you do not need a degree for. You don't have to go to uni. You actually just need to learn the technical skill. And so that is something that my parents used to do, often to early 20s boys, often, because sometimes they're the ones that can get a little bit lost. And interestingly, that is what Dave and I are now doing with our First Nations Development Program, which is training some young First Nations people in the skill of project services. Again, you don't have to go to uni for that, although we have coupled that with some formal certification. But going back to Mum and Dad, during the recession of the late 80s, early 90s, I remember professional staff, what was then just people, painting our back fence and trimming our trees on our little hobby farm and working on the property. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there were all these people just hanging out at the house doing some jobs. And I didn't know it then because I was only a kid, but later on in life I've found out and realised that that was because Mum and Dad didn't want to let anyone go. They had no work for them and they didn't want them sitting around twiddling their thumbs, because that's terrible for culture and for yourself. You know, it's not great. So they said, no worries, come and work on the property. So we had a whole team of individuals. It must have, I mean, I remember money being really, really, really tight at that point in time, but never did they miss a paycheck. And they didn't let anyone go during that time. And so that is also something that is 100% in me about staff and staff being family and staff being an extension of your family and friends, I guess.
Wow. The part there that you spoke about with Yanam Projects and the Indigenous and the First Nations program, can you tell me a bit more about that? Because that's intriguing to me.
Yeah.
And it's such a fascinating story on how you're developing young people and giving them skills and seeing them grow, you know. I'm sure you're amazed by that yourself, but tell us about that program. What does that look like?
So when we started out, we wanted to do two things. We wanted to grow a business for all the reasons that people want to grow a business. It's financial freedom and time and being your own boss and all of those things. But we also wanted to have a positive contribution on the First Nations community. Being Aboriginal, my husband being Aboriginal, we know the plight of that community, and there are systemic and intergenerational, as everyone talks about, issues and challenges. And so we thought we're in a really cool situation to be able to have a positive impact on that community. So we're doing that in a couple of ways. One way is that we have developed this First Nations Development Program, which is we We partner with host organisations, people like BHP or Tetra Tech International, and we find through our community relationships, smart, driven, intelligent, interesting, young First Nations people, men and women, that may not know what they want to do, may not have had the opportunity and foresight of all the options available to them, but are keen to make something of themselves. So we are now on to our seventh trainee, and we bring them in. And so, for example, Ella is one of ours. She worked at WGA, an engineering firm, for a year. While she did that, she did a Certificate 4 in project management. And at the end of that 12 months, we had a conversation with WGA and ourselves, and she went and did some time just employed by them. Recently, she has now come back and joined Yunnan again. I've asked Ella, you know, tell me about this program. And the thing that she has said is, it has changed my life, and she truly believes that it can change others. And that is something that Dave and I find incredibly, incredibly awesome, that we have been able to do that. So Ella and Brianna and Lisa and Timmy, these are individuals that were working at Foodland or working as a receptionist at a real estate agent, and now have a whole professional career ahead of themselves. Most of them stay with us, not all of them do, yep. For various reasons, and that's wonderful. We just want to populate, we want to give as many opportunities to First Nations people as possible. So that is something that we are doing. And the other thing that we are doing for First Nations communities is that we are working on Indigenous community projects, and they are our passion projects. We love them. We work on many, many big complex infrastructure projects. But the ones where we feel like we are best placed is, a differentiated business, I guess, is on, for example, Sujuna Health Clinic for Aboriginal Corporation, Yapla Art Gallery, which is an Indigenous art gallery in the Flinders Ranges. These sorts of projects we have Indigenous and non-Indigenous project managers working on, but we come with a lens of education and compassion and empathy and understanding that non-Indigenous businesses often cannot have. They just cannot understand the complex situations that these projects are working in, and the complex stakeholder relationships that they will have thereafter. So that is something that's really, really special to us.
Wow. I can't say wow enough, can I? It is just wow. Like, Jess, this is fantastic. You've spoken about what you're doing at the moment and how you're developing great young people, and it's almost a people strategy for your own business, you know, accidentally, organically, it's created that way. What's the legacy that you're aiming for here? What are you trying to achieve?
My legacy, or our legacy, I guess, is, I don't know, a few things. It's to make the world a better place, and that sounds awful. I mean, not awful, it sounds
cliche.
Yeah. But gee, we are genuine about it. And so that is in a few ways. We work in the built environment, so it's building things that actually have a really positive impact. And that is in a few ways. That's future proofing things so that we create a sustainable future. So we make those decisions, or we help clients make those sustainable decisions. We try and make the world aesthetically nice. You know, there is an element of that, although it's often architects and engineers that take carriage of that, but we certainly as clients reps have a hand in that. And we love to make that built environment just that it works, and it's useful, and it's pedestrian, and it's right. So that's the environment. We hope to have a positive impact on First Nations community. It's so hard. And the complexities and the troubles and the trials and tribulations they've been over the last 100 years, they're a damaged group of individuals. And I believe 100% that it is all of ours as a country to get behind, to try and support and fix, because once their culture, if we don't jump on this right now, once it is gone, it is gone. So while I am not Aboriginal, although I have an Aboriginal husband and 3 Aboriginal children, Aboriginal nieces and nephews and sister-in-laws, so a whole community of people that are very intimate to me that I care about, I am also just Australian and I am an ally. And I deeply, deeply care, as I believe so many Australians should, get on this bandwagon to care, because once their culture is gone or damaged beyond repair, it is a huge potential loss to our country. And it's really sad, you know. We go to America, not to America, we go to New Zealand, and the way they treat their Indigenous population is like special. It is, they have something really special there, and the lack of empathy and celebration that we have for Indigenous culture here is, I just find it incredibly sad. So they are the two legacies that I at least hope to have.
Yep. So, you know, you sound very driven. You've got a very clear North Star, as I like to say, where you're going, your legacy. What about some of the challenges that you've overcome? What's been the biggest challenge in business that you've had to overcome?
You know, the biggest challenge in business that I've had to overcome is having children. And that sounds ridiculous. It sounds a bit funny. I get it. But I just have found that in my 20s, I was able to rise to the challenge and rise to the challenge and rise to the challenge in business. And I had a director once in my early 20s in a development performance review. He said to me, "What's your aspirations?" And I said, "My aspirations are clearly to be sitting where you're sitting." And he laughed and he said, "I believe that you have every capability of that. The struggle you're going to have is being female." And I said, "What? That's crazy." And he didn't mean it in terms of an unconscious bias situation that we now know. This is, you know, 20 years ago. He went on to talk about the fact that having children is taking you in and out of the workforce is a real struggle. And he said, "Go and speak to some of the other senior females here." That was in bin. There was about 200 people in that office. And I said, "Okay." I thought he was crazy. And then I went to go and talk to some of the senior females and I realised there were no female directors. Yeah. They were all men. They're all men. So I found some senior females, you know, a senior project architect. At least there were a couple of them, and had a chat. But still thought, I can overcome this because I can do this. I can rise to any challenge. And so I did that in my 20s. I continued. And then when I turned 30, I had my first child. And while I was on maternity leave, I was headhunted for the state manager role. And I went to that interview and I went intent to not tell them that I was on maternity leave. And there were questions. The recruiter even told me afterwards that she tried to find out whether I had children or not, but legally you cannot. And so she made comments about her baby at the time and having spit up on her shoulder, and I just sat there and laughed. Huh. And she said afterwards she just could not read me, and that was, a struggle for her, interestingly. So I got the job, which was great. I'm one of the only women I know that have come back from maternity leave in a role that is more senior to where they left. Then for the next 10 years, my son's now 9, I have a 9, a 4 and a 1-year-old, and I've been in and out of the workforce 3 times. I've struggled with IVF, with miscarriages, with operations, all sorts of those challenges. And in that time, I've still managed to hold a global strategy role. I was leader of Oricon's office for a period of time, which is over 300 people. I still managed to hold on to roles and improve my career as I went and grab those opportunities and grab that experience. But being a female and trying to be a business leader is incredibly hard. Now, I have an 18-month-old. I'm about to turn 40 years old. I'm coming into the best 10 years of my career and I'm incredibly excited. So going into business with my husband, I'm just so excited to see what the two of us can do now that I can focus, I guess. That wasn't the answer you were expecting, was it?
Fantastic answer though. And what an inspiration for any female, let alone the guys out there that are listening to actually get that firsthand understanding of what you've been through. It really is a fantastic story to hear of how you've overcome that. To your point about starting at a place with maternity leave and then coming out even stronger, that takes a special person. Your grit and resilience, where does this come from?
I've thought a bit about that recently and I don't really know. I think I grew up in a family where my mum was not your typical mum at all. She was the mum that at school on a Friday, if my parents were coming in for the assembly or my mum was coming in the assembly, I'd be saying to her, "Mum, can you please just wear a bra?" Because she was a bit of a hippie. She was not confined by social norms at all, but she was incredibly tenacious and smart and, interesting, not confined by social norms. So I think that is part of it, that I don't get wrapped up in what other people think. Growing up in a family where my siblings were incredibly intelligent, very, very intelligent, and I did well, I was above average, but I was not on the genius status that they were. So I probably needed to work a bit harder. And so I just did. I kind of worked harder and I worked harder and I always just assumed that I would succeed. And I don't really know where that comes from, but self-belief is incredibly important to success. I don't know. I try and build that into my own kids. My son at the moment, he got above of something but not above plus recently on a few things, and I said, you do not need to be a genius. You just have to show up with enthusiasm again and again and again. And if you keep showing up with enthusiasm, success will follow. And I truly, truly believe that.
Well, living by example, obviously yourself there, Jess. So we talk about success. How do you define it? How do you define success?
That is really interesting. And I do not believe that success is finite. Success is not a point that you get to. Success is a mindset. And success is a holistic thing. It is, many people might think it is wealth. Wealth is one element, because wealth creates opportunity and it creates freedom, it creates your ability to be able to make choices for yourself. So that is one element. But for me, success is a really, really good, enriched, diverse life. And as we know from many, many studies, the happiness study and others, the thing that builds the happiest life is deep connections and deep relationships with people. And so success to me is broad. It is having those really deep connections with individuals, and it is having some wealth. It is having a business that is continuously improving, that it is a great environment. yeah, it is not a point that we need to get to. It is a way of being, I guess.
You've spoken about people here in SA, which is fantastic. You know, what else do you see in SA, the opportunities that we have here?
The biggest opportunity that we have here is the business community. It is the network. It is the ability to collaborate with people. And my friends who I went to uni with in Sydney, they do not have that. That is a different, it is different over there. They may have that within a core group, or they may be on a committee, or they have a portion of the community, a particular community. But what we have in Adelaide is that we can be part of. For example, Dave and I are part of the construction industry, and we have a very strong network in that community. But Adelaide is small enough that we're now part of the broader business community through Business SA and the 39ers, for example. I am meeting so smart, disruptive people challenging the status quo that I am learning from, and that diversity from learning from other industries and other people can only make my business in the construction industry better. And that is something really, really special about South Australia. And I believe that we are growing. And I hope that we do not grow to a size that we lose that, because that is something really special.
You touched on just quickly the 39ers there. What part does the 39ers play for your business?
What I'm finding from the 39ers are two things. One is education. I'm just learning a lot. I was contemplating going back and finishing doing some more subjects of an MBA, which I started some time ago, or doing some further study. And I chose to put that on hold and instead do something like 39ers and join up to this. And I'm thrilled because many of the events are educationally focused. Last night there was a talk by a future thinker, and I learned a lot. In fact, one of the things she talked about, which didn't surprise me but blew my mind a little bit, was that she said that because we all use our cars only about 4% of the time, private car ownership might be a thing of the past within 10 years. And that even just knowing things like that, I take that back to the built environment, the design of the built environment, and in terms of roads and bridges and houses and buildings and car parks. And I can then start to challenge the status quo in my industry. So I'm getting inherent education and knowledge around the circular economy and other things that's actually really surprised me how much I've learned already.
We gave you a question early. Gave it to you a couple of weeks out, and I believe you've got an answer for this one. If you could have a gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, metaphorically speaking, getting the message out to millions of people, Jess McDonald, what would it say?
I did think a little bit about this, and I knew instantly that it would be something around some level of equality or how we can all become equal. But the more and more I thought about it, I ended up landing on Martin Luther King's quote, which is, life's more persistent question is, what are you doing for others? And I think if we build that, what are we doing? What are you doing for others? If we all built that into our lives more around being a citizen of your community, be a citizen of the country, being a citizen of the global community, we would bring more empathy, more kindness, more positive outcomes. What are you doing for others permeates sustainability, it permeates the planet, business, everything that we do. I think if you build that in the way that you do things, the world genuinely would be a better place.
Yeah. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. What are you doing for others? So that is fantastic. One of the last questions I've got for you is, what should we be talking about? What is it that we should be talking about right now, whether it be our governments, talking to our governments, talking to our local communities, talking to business owners? What should we be talking about?
For me, being in our business, I cannot help but want that to be around the betterment of First Nations people. And I know we've talked about it, a lot of it today, but we need to do something now. And the government has is putting in the procurement policies, Indigenous procurement policies, and having minimum spends. And some what we are finding as a business is that we might be included in a tender, for example, because that is what the government wants to see. But then when the rubber hits the roads, we are not included. And we are seeing RAP plans all over the place, people promoting reconciliation action plans. And I just think that is wonderful. However, what are you actually doing that is actionable and tangible, that is not just on that piece of paper? And I've thought about this a lot as well, being in the industry that we are. And I do believe that there are two things that businesses and government, anybody that is considering a RAP plan, could be including and could be thinking about. And the two things I believe are, one is educating non-Indigenous staff on truth-telling, storytelling, the actual knowledge and education of what has actually happened to Aboriginal people over the last hundred of years, how we can have made the same mistake so many times, continuously made mistakes to create this very damaged population. I think that is key, is education. And the other thing that I get asked a lot around businesses is, where do you find these Aboriginal people to hire? We want to find one, right? One token. And I say to them, don't. Don't just think about it as finding one person to hit that RAP plan target that you have as a one-liner. Sometimes what I have seen is that retention of individual employees, Indigenous staff, when they go and join a very white, very non-Indigenous business, they often feel like they're a fish out of water. And my biggest suggestion is, instead of going out and finding your one Aboriginal person to join your organisation, find one Aboriginal business to support. Because what we know is Aboriginal businesses can support Indigenous staff far better than a non-Indigenous business can. We have 14 people, five of those are Aboriginal. So what that means is those five people have a culturally safe place to come. They are working with their own people. I know as a female, I much prefer to be working in an organisation with at least some females there. I don't want to come to work and just work in an organisation with only men. They're not my people, and that's okay. I have good relationships with men, but I want to work in an organisation with some females. That is exemplified for Aboriginal people. They want to come to work where they are working with some of their own people. So my advice for people working on their RAP plans now is, educate your non-Indigenous staff through true truth-telling. And the second is, find Aboriginal businesses to support rather than Aboriginal employees to employ. I'm not saying don't employ Aboriginal. Please, if that is an opportunity for them, open up the doors and let them walk through and support them as best as you can. But if it is one or the other, I'm suggesting that you actually find an Aboriginal business to support.
It's a wonderful answer, Jess. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for opening up. Thank you for being so candid and letting us into your world. It has been an honour for me. So thank you. That is the 39ers podcast today. Thank you, Jess. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If you found this episode valuable, be sure to subscribe and stay updated whenever we post new episodes. Stay tuned on our socials for more captivating interviews, intriguing insights, and thought-provoking discussions. Together, let's navigate the ever-evolving world of business in South Australia. I'm Tim Lavis.
Until next time, drive the change.